You're listening to A Stranger Podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, you're listening to Invisible. This is Jen Graves, and I am at the Fry Art Museum with Dario Robledo.
Hello.
Hi. Hi. Did I pronounce you correctly?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very good.
Okay, good. He's got a new show here at the Fry, and it's called Heaven is Being a Memory to Others. It's up through the summer, I think.
I think so. Yeah.
And it is going to be joined in about a month in the middle of May 17th,
yes,
with another traveling exhibition that's a 10-year survey, mm-hmm, of his work. But for now, we're going to talk about Heaven is Being a Memory to Others, which is a show that's only happening in Seattle. And the starting point for the show is Charles and Emma Fry, the,
yes,
founders of the museum.
Mm-hmm. So I was invited by Robin Held, the curator here at the Fry, to reinstall the permanent collection, and I think she knew the way I work that I would probably bring up some unknown issues about Charles and Emma themselves because of the nature of research in my work. And I think I did find some new angles on them. So not only reinstall the collection, but the door was open to make work in response to the collection if I wanted to. And I was very motivated by what I found, so I did. I made 7 new works. 4 of them are here on display at the museum with the collection.
There are 3 other works that aren't here.
Yeah, they got edited at the last second because they just... I'm trying to be a better editor on myself lately.
You were drawn to Emma.
Very, very much. Emma, what struck me about their relationship is that there are no correspondences archived between them. And for example, even her clothing, which Emma was clearly a fashionable woman. She liked nice clothes. She had a seamstress that made all her clothes. So all the clothes, all her jewelry, nobody at the museum knows what happened to any of the stuff, which I find very curious considering that they went through the trouble of making a museum, mm-hmm, for themselves, that all their personal, especially Emma's personal effects, seem to have disappeared. Maybe someone in the family, distant family member, has them, but they don't have any connection to the Fry. So that really intrigued me, but also Emma is not really credited as the active one in the selection of the collection.
Mm-hmm.
Charles, and he was, of course, the driving force, but the more I learned about Emma, the more I realized, I don't think it was coincidental, some of the paintings they own and what I knew about her. I'm sure she was behind, mm-hmm, their acquisitions, but she just wasn't properly credited for it. And so that, but also what I do know about her biography, and there's very little to know because of the lack of correspondence, but the whole idea so Charles left, he moved to establish himself. So the customs of the time, you know, the man going off, establishing himself, calling on his future bride to then join him. That whole formality, there had to have been a correspondence of that era. And I'm fascinated by things like that. Like, how was their courtship being maintained, or how was he courting her when he was still making it rather than having already made it? And then the other big point is that Emma did have a miscarriage right after they got married, and it literally has one sentence devoted to it in the only book that I was able to find about their history. And it's never mentioned again. No mention of children are ever brought up, just that she wanted any. So in that era, that was very unusual to not have children, especially a prominent family who's obviously worried about their legacy with the museum. So those are my jumping off points, was how to flesh Emma out more, mm-hmm, and give her more of a voice in what I think she did to found this collection, mm-hmm. but also what were the personal drives that were pushing her to push Charles to buy this painting over that painting. Mm-hmm. And I think it's got to be related to her experience with the miscarriage and not having children later, which, again, I don't know, did the miscarriage harm her in some way that she couldn't? There's just no record of it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's coincidental, the predominance of children portraits or women holding a newborn or women in their youth. It just doesn't seem coincidental to me.
There are a lot of paintings in the collection about that.
Yes. And they're all very idealized mm-hmm. versions as well. And then there's some direct portraits, like artists who are painting their own daughter artists painting their family, which mm-hmm. I found very interesting too. Mm-hmm. That so we have the idealized, like, Madonna and Child paintings, and then we have an actual portrait of the artist's family. So in my mind, she went from the idealized version to this is someone who had the privilege of painting their own children, mm-hmm. which she didn't, obviously never had mm-hmm. The chance to have her child portrait commissioned or something like that.
Yeah. So. Well, it's funny because there's a pattern of Charles and Emma being a pair and there being another element between them in the way the show is set up. So, and often, usually, that's the triangulation of the mother and father and the child. Mm-hmm. And there's often this kind of unknown element mm-hmm. in the show where you'll see, two portraits of Charles and Emma and then, or two portraits of something, mm-hmm. something sort of that, mm-hmm. that kind of goes together. And then a third portrait, there's one room where the third portrait is a woman turning away
yeah.
from the painter. Mm-hmm. So there's also, this funny way in which the Fry's classic chairs mm-hmm. have three sides, yeah. And they're all sort of sitting in the galleries.
Yeah, I love those chairs.
Yeah, and the, the portraits you're talking about the artists who painted their own children or their own families, mm-hmm. you have used those in this installation and mm-hmm. combined that with your yes. own works, your mm-hmm. own responses. There's one of your works is sort of a traveling box mm-hmm. for immortality. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that work?
Sure. It's called... God, I'm blanking. God, I'm blanking on my title.
Don't worry.
I have so many titles in my head right now. It'll come to me in a second. But it's based on a traveling salesman that... What if he was door-to-door salesman could sell immortality? And what it looks like is it's this very odd 19th century sort of steamer trunk style. It's divided into two when the door is open, and that you see 10 hourglasses that are descending in size from 8 hours to 4 minutes. And there's two sets on both sides. And so
and they're laying down like barbells.
Yes, mm-hmm. and they're laying flat, and the case has a coffin-like feel. So in most of my works, I like them to have a tension between what they're trying to accomplish and then a realization that it's probably not going to work. and that's something that's pretty common in a lot of my works. I like that tension between the two. So in a way, this traveling salesman is trying to sell eternal life, but it's put in a box that looks like it failed because mm-hmm. it's like a coffin. And then there's the tension within each hourglass between an hourglass, can essentially tell time forever. You just keep mm-hmm. turning it. But what instead of sand, what's within these hourglasses is my own homemade concoction of a medicinal attempt at immortality. Mm-hmm. And it has some very special ingredients. A few of them audio tape of some very wonderful recordings. And in my work, sound is very important. And I have an idea that I call audio relics. That I like the idea that, you know, we understand relichood within the material world, like a bone of a saint or something like that. But we don't often think of sound having a relic ability, because of its ephemeral nature. But there really are just some amazing recordings out there that I've been able to find and use. So the two that I used in this work are a recording of the couple who holds the world record for being married. They were married for 80 years, and it's a sweet little recording of them talking about the secrets to a long marriage. Mm-hmm. And when you just think about bonds and not letting go of them, not letting bonds break, I mean, they are at a cusp that very, well, only they have reached. And so in a way, you could say they're at this extreme threshold of humanness. Mm-hmm. If part of being human is establishing and holding on to bonds. Mm-hmm. So I have a fascination with the whole Guinness Book World Records, a really healthy one, because it's not odd. It's just, I love that book, and it's a continuous source of inspiration to me, because the whole book is about the edges of the strangeness of being human. Mm-hmm. I can tell you some more about that. But anyway, this recording is in there, and then the other...
When you say the recording is in there, you mean...
Yes, because as a sculptor and a artist interested in materials, I often try to find how to materialize sound. Mm-hmm. And that's really rooted in my interest in DJing and sampling and DJ culture. So, you know, the physicality of two turntables and records and the manipulation of those records, it's come natural to me to assume that chunk of vinyl can be manipulated in a number of ways as material. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you melt records down.
Yeah, I've done pretty much everything you can to a record, audio tape, wax cylinders. Mm-hmm. You have to assume that the sound source, I mean the sound itself or the idea of it, is still embedded within the vinyl whenever I alter it. So I asked the viewer to come along with me in that way, and a lot of materials ask similar things from my viewer. So in this case, this recording was transferred to audio tape, and then I've been doing work with audio tape for a while now, where again I after you get it out of the cassette, what can you do with it? Grind it, melt it, dissolve it, everything. But in this case, it's this process of stretching it and pulling it. I heat it up a little, mm-hmm. and I'm able to stretch it almost thin enough as a hair, which allows me to manipulate it in a number of ways, so that you know, I can braid it, I can treat it as I would hair, which is an important aspect when it merges with my interest in Victorian mourning traditions, especially hair wreaths and hair flowers. Mm-hmm. But I'm going off on a tangent. But the piece has the recording inside of it, and it has one other amazing recording. The way I describe it is the first audio recording of time, and what it is. I paint this little picture for you, because this is the way I imagined it. So the technology of recording sound, the mechanics of it that Edison was searching for, he was actually beat by several years. In 1878, the very first recording was made on a cylinder. And so think about this. The inventor, Frank Lambert, he's sitting there. You know the technology on your table could change the world, which it has, being able to record ourselves. And if you think about we've all lost touch with this idea, and Edison says this a number of times, that his desire to perfect this technology was an attempt at immortality.
Was.
Yes. I mean, this was how... So history is littered with attempts at immortality. They're just... We all assume it's in the body, but there's a number of other ways it can happen. And, I mean, when's the last time any of us recorded each other thinking, I've cheated death? It just doesn't come up anymore. But so I say that so that you know what was at stake to those inventors' minds. I mean, there's a lot at stake there. So then think about this. So you have that equipment in front of you. You know the world could change if this works. What do you record? It seems like such a big responsibility. What's the first thing you're ever going to record? You know, and this is going to be forever. So what does it record? And I think it's so beautiful that something in him impulsively told him to record time. Mm-hmm. So what you hear is him counting down time. He's going 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, wow. 4 o'clock. It just seems so fitting that the ticking of time would somehow instinctually come to him to say it out loud. So it's the earliest recording of time. It's also the earliest recording of a human voice. It's a whole bunch of things, I think, really interesting mixed into it. So that recording is also mm-hmm. within the hourglasses. So if you imagine that ticking down time rather than sand. Mm-hmm.
So there are also plants in it.
There's some botanical elements. Mm-hmm. There's a...
Redemption flower? Is that what it's called?
It's called the resurrection plant.
Resurrection plant.
and it's a plant that I'm very fond of. I've used many times in my work. And old wives' tales, old folk medicine traditions, which I'm very fond of because the amount of... The role of belief... that goes into the success or failure of them is really important to me because I see really no different in what I make as an artist. Mm-hmm. I'm asking a similar thing that your grandmother asks of you when she gives you a medicine that science would laugh at, you know. Mm-hmm. But because you believe and love her, it does have an effect. It does work. So to me, that's been a great model to think about art itself, is that its success or failure can be if it gets the viewer to come along and have a sense of faith or trust in it for curative potential or a number of things. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I like that model.
Go ahead. Oh, I just wanted to say one of the things that is kind of important to that question of trust is that the materials that you say you use, mm-hmm. you do actually use. Some of them seem completely out of this world, like, you know, an audio recording of the people who've been married the longest mm-hmm. or the first. One of the materials is fulgurite, mm-hmm. which seems incredible. What can you say what that is?
So fulgurite is glass produced by lightning strikes, and it's a beautiful substance. When lightning strikes the desert, it melts the sand around it into glass. So you touch on one of the central philosophies in my belief as an artist, which is related to the folk medicine tradition in a similar way, is that I want to make things that skirt the fantastical, that push the viewer to stretch what they think's possible. Mm-hmm. And that often means, you know, belief is worked into that because you have to believe that this is possible for you to accept it. Mm-hmm. But the reason I do that, so that, well, I'll back up, that desire to get to that edge of the fantastical, it merges with my absolute belief that it's, at the end of the day, it has to be rooted in the real world. Mm-hmm. So that's another healthy tension. Mm-hmm. And the reason I have followed this philosophy is because if you can show that the world is already beautiful and magical in its own right, there's something so much more exciting about that to me when the magic is attainable, mm-hmm. That you don't have to make up anything. Mm-hmm. Though just look around and you find, you know, there's lightning glass or there's glass produced by a meteorite, or I mean, I can go on this amazing list mm-hmm. of things, but that's when I think art's really interesting, and my great art experiences have done that for me. Mm-hmm. They've asked me to expand what I thought the world was the day before, and it got a little bigger the next day, or more rich. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that's the model I'm trying to follow as well.
You talked the other day about it being sort of like a magic trick, where you know something's wrong, you know they're faking it, mm-hmm. but what if they weren't?
Like, yeah. So, I mean, because we all grow up, and I love magic, definitely, but we all grow up knowing we're getting fooled. Mm-hmm. And we go along with it. We suspend our belief for a moment, and we get entertained, and then we think, okay, but it wasn't real. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the, there's an enjoyment in that. But I always say, well, what if you pulled the curtain to the side and there was no one back there? Mm-hmm. It really happened. Mm-hmm. And then what are you going to do? Because mm-hmm. then you have to reshift the way you think about the world. If what you thought was impossible a moment before, suddenly it's possible. Mm-hmm. So that's why all my materials are always rooted in facts. The historical stories that I'm drawn to, which often fuel my projects, they are also just seem like that couldn't have happened, mm-hmm. but they're also always rooted in fact. And then the issue of, you know, did you really do this, or is this really the thing that I say it is? I can go into that pretty deeply, because mm-hmm. that starts to address my attitude about the state, not just of the art world, but the world itself right now, in that it's hyper cynicism, and mm-hmm. that the role that irony plays, this unhealthy kind of irony that only produces suspicion mm-hmm. or lack of engagement or apathy or being apolitical, like all these things I see happening. That this term I've come up with on this topic is or phrase is, what does it say about our culture when to be sincere has become the radical gesture? Like, how did things get so mm-hmm. upended that if I walk in the room and as an artist and say I really did do that, mm-hmm. that's shocking. Mm-hmm. Well, why is that shocking? Mm-hmm. Isn't the way it's supposed to be? So, but it's gotten to, to me, lying at the end of the day is just, it's just boring. It's boring, and it's fitting into a worldview that I am adamantly opposed against. Mm-hmm. So for me to not do it, just personally, it's boring, but on the biggest level, it would be incredibly hypocritical. And against every philosophy that I'm mentioning right now, that a magic that is attainable, and then I didn't try to attain it, really? That would just, it doesn't make sense. So I can go on and on about this, but at the end of, you know, artists, at the end of the day, you put your thing out in the world, and people do what they do. And, mm-hmm. you know, maybe 20% of the people come along, maybe... I don't know, maybe it could be higher, but there'll be a percentage that won't accept it. And to me, that's fine. That's just as legitimate, because I want to make works that do draw a line in the sand, and mm-hmm. Either you're going to come across it or you're not, and either way is fine with me, but I do want to make objects that force some position, mm-hmm. because art that doesn't ask anything of me, I just don't find interesting. And I want to follow a model of the artists who have asked a lot of me. Mm-hmm. And I've went along with them, mm-hmm. even if I didn't agree with them.
Who are some of those?
Well, a lot of people. Let's see. I was a huge Smiths fan. Mm-hmm. I take being a fan very serious. I think I'm really good at being a fan, and every band, if I like a band, then they're guaranteed a lifetime fan from me, because that like fandom has become a philosophy almost, like it's about commitment. So if I like Duran Duran, I'm not going to give them up when I got older. And so
do you?
I do. Yeah. No, every band I liked when I was 12, I can dislike them later, but I haven't lost touch with what they're up to.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be an active fan forever, because I think I like the part of the fanatic part of fandom is this extreme commitment. Even if that commitment becomes unfashionable, or you don't really get anything out of it anymore, or it doesn't matter. The point is about the commitment. That outweighs all the other stuff. So with that said, if I name some things that seem out of date, that's what I'm... That's why. So anyway, the Smiths, though, I mean, they're always going to be cool, so it's okay to talk about them. But then, you know, within the Smiths, there are many fans who, once Morrissey went solo, just forgot about Morrissey. And so what I'm saying is that I haven't lost. I know everything that's going on with every member right this moment. And I haven't given up on any of them. So, for example, the Smiths, I guess I was 13, maybe, when I first saw the album Mita's Murder. And that was a turning point in my life, big time. I'll never forget the day that I was spending the night with some friends at my friend's house, a sleepover. And the next day we were going to go to the mall as a group, you know, and this was, I don't know, seventh grade, I guess.
Maybe. In Texas?
Yeah. And I remember I was very much into heavy metal at the time. San Antonio's a strong heavy metal community. I really loved all those heavy metal groups. So, and all my friends did too. So we went to the mall, and I remember we went to the record store, and each of us, you know, one guy was going to get the new Def Leppard album. One guy's going to get the new Whitesnake album. One was going to get, you know, Megadeth album. And I remember I was walking down the record aisle, and out of the side of my eye, I saw the cover to Mita's Murder. And I had never heard of the Smiths, nothing. And I remember I was mesmerized by that album cover. Mm-hmm. And I just kept looking at it. And when I look back, I can say that was my first truly aesthetic experience. Like, mm-hmm. That's when something clicked. And I bought the album just based on that image. And my friends made complete fun of me, because it looked gay, you know, and that compared to the heavy metal stuff. And so I insisted I was going to buy it. So I bought it. We get back to his house, and I insisted that I play mine first. And I remember the first time I heard Morrissey's voice, and it just cleared the room. All my friends left immediately. They were just not going to... It's, you know, all the masculinity issues at that age are really weird, and... anyway, I realized, whoa, this is going to be a lifetime commitment.
Did you become a DJ?
I did, but I made I'm glad I figured it out quickly. I realized I was never going to be a great DJ, but I maybe could be a good artist.
Yeah.
So what's key about those years is that I just took that language and vocabulary and just instinctually applied it. Mm-hmm. To the sculptural world. Mm-hmm. It never occurred to me not to, and so all the interesting things have happened along the way. But I'll wrap up the Morrissey story. So, but the reason I brought it up is because the Smiths then became the model of, when I got a new Smiths record, I knew something was expected of me. I knew I was going to need to know the obscure reference Morrissey's making on the album cover, to a filmmaker or a pop star from the 60s, or he would reference a historical figure or a new word. Like, I didn't know the word sycophant. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I didn't understand the lyrics because there were new words. So it was not uncommon for me to have my dictionary and my encyclopedia out at the same time I opened the record, put it on, and I knew I was going to need to do some work. So what I love is that he and the Smiths assumed the viewer was going to want to do a little work. Mm-hmm. To complete the artwork. Mm-hmm. And that's the model I'm trying to follow today. And then in our present climate, that's become pretty radical to assume your viewer's smart mm-hmm. and that they will want to engage rather than they're dumb and they need to be spoon-fed. So even if an artist even assumes that from square one, that, you know what, my viewer is smart, that's become radical instead of that's the way it should be. Mm-hmm. And that irritates me. But so that's why I brought that story up, because that really was setting the model that I was going to follow. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, 100 bands since have also fit that role for me.
You've talked about your use of materials, you know, sort of taking them and changing them and using materials that are real and old and mm-hmm. And you've melted down your mother's records, mm-hmm. things like that. You've talked about sampling as an ethics. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think sampling has not reached its full potential on so many levels, politically, ethically, environmentally, on a generational level. Unfortunately, it's understood on the mass level as theft or unoriginality. And I don't blame mass culture for understanding it that way, because they're right in many ways. The mainstream radio, the examples of sampling that are on the top 40 are, in my opinion, those things. If you just rap on top of an old song, that's not very interesting to me. So this form of sampling that's always excited me is the spirit, like in early hip-hop, in its origins, were, you know, sampling, using the record that is right there in front of you, manipulating it in such a way that some new story has come out of it by just simple hand manipulations on a turntable. But you're using, you know, an old Elton John record or something. But it's no longer about Elton John. It was about that's what's available. This is the scrap around me, and I'm going to use it. And that, to me, that speaks to a deep human quality about the need to create, even in the worst circumstances, financially or during times of war, or during times of mourning. History is littered with these examples that I would put under the category of sampling. But, you know, like mourning, the Victorian mourning tradition, that's never been talked about within sampling language. But to me, the spirit is the same. The words just change over time.
What do you mean by that?
I guess, I'm getting off. Getting too abstract. So in morning, in the morning arts, morning crafts and traditions, you use, in many cases, it's using the actual materials of the battlefield. Let's say a bullet casing that a soldier is in a trench, and that's the only thing available.
Right.
And yet, trench art, which is another, I would also argue, is a form of sampling.
Trench art,
which is a really unfortunately unknown form of art that is just staggeringly beautiful to me. I just continually am overwhelmed by it. But trench art, like morning art, the point is that you're using the things around you that were probably, well, number one, they would have been scrap, or they would have, like a trench art, been the source of your potential death, even, mm-hmm. like a bullet casing.
Pain.
Yeah. But then you upend its original use by your creative gesture towards it. Mm-hmm. And so that's where sampling gets really powerful. Mm-hmm. And to me, speaks to something deeply human, that even if you have the scraps, if all you have are scraps around you, so what? You're still going to do something with it. Mm-hmm. And then when you place it, When we fast forward to today, and you place it in a generational context, and how hip hop formed, it's no different. You use the scraps around you, and you upend the use to make something more beautiful. I mentioned the sort of postmodern irony and the whatever could be done has been done sort of attitude that I feel very much that I grew up in. And I love that the sampling is a total rejection of that whole attitude. Mm-hmm. It's saying, you know, so what? That I'm still going to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's a wonderful philosophy. But I will, to get back to your original thing about ethics, to me, sampling is also very much about remembering. Because I really do think that to be a good DJ or sampler, you need to know what you're using. What's the scrap you're using? Where and why are you changing it into whatever you change it into? Mm-hmm. Because in the process, that's where the richness is about how can that history mutate into this history? Mm-hmm. And what conversation occurred along the way? Mm-hmm. So sampling to me is remembering itself. And as an artist, I really believe this. I think artists have a moral responsibility to remember. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a, you know, it sounds weird to use the words morals and ethics, but it shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And it bothers me that the cynicism of and the irony of a generation is limiting our ability to talk that way. Mm-hmm. Those aren't dirty words. So I think, I really do, I think artists, when you're living in a time where the culture is obsessed with the new and the next, and that anything that has the scent of being outdated is thrown away and discarded, that has deep ramifications on our ability to not repeat the mistakes of the past. I can go on and on about this, but when you frame sampling as an act of remembering, and then you say, well, there's a moral responsibility as an artist to remember while others are going to forget, then that sort of sampling has now, for me, become a moral thing. Mm-hmm. And that's why my work deals so much with history, because, you know, the majority of us aren't going to remember World War I. Mm-hmm. And what startles me about that is when World War I happened, everybody said, this is the war of all wars. This can never happen again. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just look at the papers of the era, and everybody said, we will never forget. We will never let this happen again. Unprecedented levels of dead and destruction. Mm-hmm. We were in our Second World War a few decades later. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just blows my mind. So what young artist today walks around worried about World War I anymore? Mm-hmm. It's just not. But anyway, my point is that I do. I want. I worry about it. And the title of the show, I'll wrap it up this way. This is another belief of mine, is that heaven is being a memory to others. And that, so in that title, what I'm implying is that my whole belief system itself to live beyond the body is tied up with others remembering me. Mm-hmm. So if you have that much writing on remembering, then it really gets, it gets heavy. It's a big thing to think about. So that's why I've decided I'm an artist. I have a function in society, and one of them is that as long as I remember, as long as one person remembers, then that thing has cheated death in some way. And as soon as we forget, then in a way, all those people have died a second death. They died the first time, and then they died the day the last person remembered them. Mm-hmm. And so I just think we each have each generation has a responsibility to the last, because we're going to ask that the same thing of the unborn one day. We're going to want them to remember us for the same reasons I'm saying. And so anyway, it's just acknowledging that it's a lineage, mm-hmm. an unbroken chain that each generation has to have a responsibility to what came before. Mm-hmm. So, okay.
Is it a coincidence that you are making work that's often about loss.
No. Related to that is what I mentioned a while ago about the morning arts or trench art, which is that the great forms of hope and even, I would argue, new leaps in aesthetics, great mourning and loss within the visual arts has not really, I've never found how it properly historicized to say, you know, how when someone is in a deep sense of mourning, how have they contributed to aesthetics, visual aesthetics, for example? And time and again, it's happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I'm so drawn to, is that it's not about staying in the mournful position. It's about acknowledging it and dealing with it creatively to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
So the greatest, I always say the greatest forms of hope lie within the greatest loss. Like that's where we're going to find the best of us, isn't the worst of us. So there's a deep philosophy there too. But on a personal level, you know, I was raised by my grandmother and my mother, who, beautiful, wonderful women, who definitely had their own kind of melancholy that definitely was grew up around. And my mother ran a honky-tonk in Texas when I was a little boy. And if anyone knows the particular melancholy of a honky-tonk, they'll understand that if you're sitting in there as a little boy watching watching people interact while the jukebox is playing, it does something. Like weird things connect in your head about how music really is speaking about life and how life influences art, the topics that a musician would write about. So I don't know, something instinctually clicked in those years. My mother, after the honky-tonk era, she was the director of a hospice for 18 years.
Wow.
And again, because of my great connection to both of them.
That's quite a career path, by the way.
So, somewhere between a honky-tonk and a hospice, is Dario is formed. But again, what is the beautiful thing about hospice is that you can leave life with dignity,
mm-hmm.
and that you should the end of life should be as dignified as the entrance to life.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the same time, the emotional toll that took on my mother dealing with it every day was extreme. And you know, I sensed it and I saw it and I heard about the stories. When I got older, I worked there myself. This was years before I was even, art, being an artist was not even on the radar. It was just, that was just the life. And now I see, oh, okay, it's not coincidental that I'm drawn to this. But it is, I do want to stress, it's not about wallowing or self-pity. It is not about that at all. It is about, time and again, I've seen the best of us comes out in the worst. And that's, I don't know, that's a great idea to me. That I think art can continue to shine light on historical examples of that. History's just littered with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It just, you have to find it. You have to look for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very, very important time in my life, the hospice thing. What else?
Well, that seems like a good place to stop.
Okay.
Thank you so much for doing this.
You're welcome. And thanks for having me.
Yeah. You've been listening to Invisible, the Stranger's Weekly Conversation with People in Art.